This morning I informed the Cabinet that I'll ask the President to dissolve the 32nd Dáil. I've always said that the election should happen at the best time for the country. Now is that time.
And therefore, if that is achieved, that you do have the possibility of creating greater growth in the society and creating better jobs.
Are we certain that we actually have the critical mass of public infrastructure and public service capacity to ensure that we can keep this golden goose that we have and that we can actually be the family that makes future generations better off?
Business at the ballot box. Be the voice.
And welcome back to Business at the Ballot Box, a daily general election podcast series brought to you by IBEC, the voice of Irish business. I'm Patrick Haughey, and in today's episode, we are focusing on Ireland's education system, which has been described as being in a crisis situation. In yesterday's episode, we heard about the incredible opportunity that Ireland has right now to become a major digital player on the world stage, but that government policy and a full pipeline of talent are key to realising that ambition. Today, we are going to be asking if the current education system is capable of feeding that talent pipeline, and if not, what does it need to do so? Shortly, I'll be meeting Alistair Blair, Country Managing Director for Accenture Ireland, who has an awful lot to say about this issue. He's going to be talking about how the education system can evolve to meet the needs of a rapidly evolving business landscape. And he was also at an event in Dublin recently where Apple's Tim Cook made some interesting comments about the education system and Ireland's talent pool. So we'll be talking a bit about that as well. But first, let's meet today's panel, who, of course, also have a lot to say about this issue. I'm joined by Lorna Fitzpatrick, President of the Union of Students in Ireland, Jim Miley, Director General of the Irish Universities Association, and Claire McGee, Head of Education and Innovation Policy at IBEC. And Claire, I'm going to start with yourself, because over the last few years, as we mentioned in yesterday's episode, we have seen incredible transformation around business and industry and society. But has the education system in Ireland kept pace with that?
Well, I think that's one of the biggest challenges businesses are facing at the moment, is the fact that we're at this kind of real point of pivot in terms of our transformation, but also as well that many of the workers are also using more and more technology in their day-to-day lives. So are we developing that pipeline that business is going to need for the future? And sometimes we wonder if the key skills that business have. So we look at kind of reports coming out from the Higher Education Authority that says employers are incredibly happy with the deep technical skills that the education system is developing at the moment. But probably we still have some question marks over maybe some of those more transversal skills. And I often like to call these, you know, the soft skills, but actually they're going to be the hard skills for the 21st century. And what we need to see is, and I think Alistair Blair in his piece will probably talk to this around how you bring together technology and people, because in modern business at the moment, it's going to be around how people embed that technology and also how can they then influence other people to use that technology. So I wonder now if the education system is also at that point of pivot. Is it also slightly disrupting to be able to develop these type of skills that are needed for the 21st century? And I think some institutions are doing it incredibly well, but they're probably very much challenged at a resource perspective to be able to do that. And I think that's one of the key things that we want to discuss today in this podcast is, in advance of the next government, is how do we get a greater focus on the need for greater resources, in particularly in our higher education system. Because back to that point of pivot for Irish industry, the key challenges are going to be about growing that talent pipeline, growing our intellectual property, growing our innovation capacity, and the higher education system and the research system is going to be the key enabler of that.
Because it has been a bit of a stark few years, particularly, I suppose, in the university sector, and a couple of statistics that may not be so pleasant.
Absolutely. We now no longer have an Irish university in the top 100. We also spend half what the EU average spend on higher education. And in the last 10 years, funding has reduced by almost 40%, while student numbers have increased by 25%. So if you think about that, just in pure accounting terms, it does not stack up. And Ireland is trying to trade itself internationally as a knowledge-based economy, but we're not investing in developing that strong, robust knowledge pipeline that we absolutely have to do. And those are just very headline figures. I don't want to go into the depths of those figures, but they are the figures that will worry future business investment, looking at their future investment strategies. And they kind of go, well, do we invest in Ireland or do we invest elsewhere? And that's something that we need to kind of get to the heart of right now and make a significant change on that.
Jim Miley, as Director General of the Irish Universities Association, you've had a first-hand account of what has been happening over the last few years. And I guess this must be very concerning for you.
Yes, it is. I think Claire has characterised it very well. What are we trying to do here? We're like, this is about our people and about our country. And, you know, I think everyone agrees that if we are to succeed as a country, we need to be a serious competitor on the international stage as a knowledge economy. Our people really is our only great natural resource that we have. I was watching TV the other night. I'm not a great routine fan of the Great British Bake Off, but as I was watching it, I thought about this. And essentially, what you know, as a country, as a government, our government is trying to bake a winning cake. But what are the critical ingredients of that cake? So the higher education, you know, the teaching and learning piece is absolutely fundamental. We're the last leg of the pipeline into the workforce on that. And the second key ingredient is our research and innovation, which again, the vast bulk of that, the base research, the really innovative research that's done is originated or run through our universities and other higher education institutions. So if we don't have the right ingredients in place, we're not going to have a winning cake for the future. It's as basic as that. And obviously, this isn't, I think, just about the funding. What we're saying to the incoming government, whoever it is we need to reset the relationship of the state with the higher education sector and with the employers as the third ring in that relationship. And I think that relationship is not just about the funding. Obviously, funding is critical. But also, I think it's about how the system interacts with the state in terms of the unnecessary controls and restrictions that are put on the sector. But I think we're also conscious as a sector that we do need to reset the relationship with industry. And I think there are some very good examples of how institutions work with business. But I don't think it's universal across the system. And I think we as a sector recognise that and we're very willing to change it. But I think all parties need to work together on this if we're to bring about those changes.
You said a couple of years ago, just a quote that sort of struck me, and you said, I think it was 2018, you said, "The house is not burning down, but we are smelling the smoke. And if we don't address this soon, we're going to do some serious damage." Has anything been addressed since you made those comments, or are we still in free fall, not to be too dramatic about it?
Well, I think there's a bit more smoke in the house. And now, in fairness, I think, you know, the outgoing government have put in extra money, so we've moved from a position where, if you look at the direct funding per student that the state puts into third level, it was at back 10 years ago at 9,000. It dipped to about 4,700. It's back up towards 5,500. But as Claire said, that's still 40% behind where it was. So progress has been made. And of course, the challenge is that there are more and more students coming into the system. And we now know that by the Department of Education's own estimates, there'll be another 36,000 coming in the next 10 years. So they've got to fund those. They've got to fix the current system and then fund the extra coming in. And that's before we even begin to talk about the extra demands that we have to cater for in terms of lifelong learning, because that's absolutely fundamental as well.
So you mentioned that funding isn't the only thing here, but I do want to stick with that for a moment, because Lorna Fitzpatrick, President of the Union Students of Ireland, this funding issue is very much high up on your agenda for this election and beyond.
Yes, most definitely. And look, we do agree with Jim that it's not solely about funding, and that's not the one-stop shop solution, but it is part of the core solution. As has been mentioned, 40% less per student while we have increase in student numbers. And I think we need to look at the fact that, like, our institutions and universities are nearly like small cities, or some of them are quite large cities in themselves. And so there's a network there of supports that are needed to ensure that we have a good education system. And so when students are struggling in terms of accessing academic supports or other types of supports on campus, that has an impact on their overall educational experience. And so we need to fund the entire ecosystem to be that sustainable and innovative environment that we need it to be. And when the funding has been reducing by the state, we have seen non-state funding increasing. And I think it's important to note that quite a lot of that is actually student fees. And I think that's an important point, because while it has been referenced that we're falling in the rankings, and look, we're not the biggest fan of the rankings, but they have a place and they are used. So we need to recognise that while our space in the rankings continues to fall, and we rely on student fees as a non-exchequer funding source, that if our place in the rankings continue to fall, we're not going to be as attractive to international students. And so that's a massive risk to our sector in terms of sustainable funding moving forward. It's not a sustainable funding model. So that has to be a key concern for the next government and a priority for the next government.
In terms of the actual impact on your members and the people that you represent, what, just to really ground this, what does that sort of crisis in funding mean on a day-to-day basis on a practical level?
Yeah, I suppose there's a broad range of things. It's anything from accommodation and being able to live somewhere close so that you can actually engage fully in your educational experience, to increase in student staff ratios that are now 20 to 1, where the OECD average is 15. So that has a massive impact in terms of in the classroom learning. Also impacts in terms of technological advancements and the equipment and things like that that are being used in our lecture theatres and labs across the country. And so they all add up. But then when you look at, I suppose, the soft skills that Claire spoke about, like, they are the key skills moving forward. And being able to develop them in a classroom setting, in a lecture theatre, but also in the university and institution space is key. And space, unfortunately, isn't there. So that kind of area to engage in debate and so on is sometimes not easily accessible. And then when you look at support services, like if you're looking at academic support services, there's increased waiting lists. You're looking at mental health support services, there's extreme long waiting lists in different higher education institutions. And that's an overall personal experience, I suppose, when you come to education. It's a wraparound support that we need to invest in to ensure that people can achieve the best.
I think Lorna is so right on this. The president of UCC just said to me recently that the population of UCC is larger than the population of Kilkenny City. So, I mean, if you think of it in those terms, the issues that Lorna raises about, you know, mental health supports, the other welfare supports that students need, as the funding has reduced, it's those services that have got hit. So, you know, it's the academic welfare. So we all talk about the output of the graduates and all that, but actually, it's the well-being and the welfare of students that's equally important, and we need a properly funded system,
which
in
is
order
very
to do
important
that.
As people transition onto the next phase of their lives, which ultimately will be into the workforce. So you want to ensure that, and from a business perspective, business is looking to hire all-rounded individuals. In that sense, it's not just what we don't want to kind of have this discussion that this is what industry is asking solely from the university or institute of technology sector. We're actually ensuring that the education system is part of a vibrant society, of which is also a vibrant economy. And I think this, by focusing on it, it really delivers a win-win-win-win, a win for government in terms of higher level activity in terms of innovation, higher level kind of quality of jobs, a win for the student and the learner and the graduate then as they try to transition to the next phase of their lives, a win for the institutions themselves as they become back to that kind of large pillar of the communities and large infrastructure across Ireland, across the region, and then also a win for Irish business in the sense that they can engage better with the system to be able to develop the products of the future. You talked about basic research there. That's where many of the original ideas of a lot of our kind of commercial innovations have originated from. But we can only really work together if the resources and if the framework is conducive to enable that. And what we've probably seen over the last little while is pockets of good activity. So this kind of competitive funding programs, which has eroded then, I think, at an institutional level, the institution's ability to plan best for their community, be that the community of business that they serve, the community in their region, and their community of students. And in a sense, then, everyone's kind of rushing to submit competitive funding calls, but it might not align very well with their mission or their targeted strategy over the next little while. So what we're probably asking for in IBEC is very much
kind of focus on core funding and to enable the institutions then to deliver their own plans and then respond well to this programmatic funding rather than drive the attention in one particular way. And Jim, you mentioned lifelong learning. That's a key focus for IBEC over the next few years. The reason being, we talked about skill change and skills demand and how it's not a very nice thing to say, but ultimately, you know, the shelf life of skills is actually eroding very quickly because of new technologies and how they're applied and how they're going to be used. And as a result, the pressure is going to become on us that we all have to invest in ourselves and invest in our skills, not just for our employability, but also for our life and how we continue to do that. And one of the questions I would have back then to the education system, how are we preparing learners, students, workers, even academics who to undertake this concept of culture of lifelong learning? Because it's just going to have to become a new norm. And how will the next government fund, support and encourage that culture to really to take hold?
And yes, and funding is obviously part of that culture. But Jim, culture needs to evolve without funding as well. It's just simply culture. Do you believe that there is that culture in the university sector at the moment? Is that evolution happening?
I think there, as Claire said, there are fantastic examples of great practice and really innovative programs that are happening both on the teaching side and on the research side. I think the challenge is that in some instances those are pockets rather than it being universal across all institutions. Both universities and third level colleges are no different to any organisations who have a legacy. And you know, there are legacy issues to be dealt with. I think the senior leadership in the university sector certainly are very much trying to break down any of the bad practices in that legacy and create more innovative and flexible institutions. But one key barrier to doing that is outside of the funding thing altogether, is we are still tied to very restrictive, effectively public sector practices, particularly when it comes to employment controls and things like that. Now, there is a reason for that. The state will say that they take up the liability for the pensions. But essentially, we have this kind of bizarre situation that has now emerged. The seven universities that we represent all now get less than 50% of their funding from the state, and in some cases as little as a one-third of their funding. And yet the instruments of control on them, while that has been happening, have actually increased substantially. So they now have far more controls, unnecessary controls in some instances, than they had 10 or 15 years ago when they were getting 70 or 80% state funding. So what we're saying in terms of resetting this relationship with government, we're saying, remove some of those unnecessary controls. Let's have a really strong accountability for the state money that we get, and indeed for any money that can we get. And I think we're working really hard to ensure that those structures and processes are in place. But then let the institutions, as Claire says, get on with delivering what they need for their students, for their, be it undergrad students, be it lifelong learners who come back into the systems, and also for the research and innovation agenda.
Lorna, would you favour that idea of reform among the entire sector?
Yeah, I think that most definitely. And I think there's a balance to be struck between accountability and control and that. So I think that we would agree with Jim in that area. In relation to lifelong learning, I think the World Economic Forum said that 65% of the children who are in school today are going to work in jobs that don't even exist yet. And that's going to continue to be the case. So we need to be innovative in our higher education institutions to make sure that we're training people with the right soft skills, as we've spoken about, but also the technical skills to engage in the world of work, whatever way that will look in the next couple of years. So that investment in lifelong learning and that culture around lifelong learning is really important. And I think it's something that as a recent graduate is something that we're very aware of. And I think that it's only becoming more and more common and more there's more and more awareness being built around it for current students and recent graduates. We recognise the fact, you had Friends of the Earth on, Oisín was on, speaking about the environment and so on previously. And like the environmental challenges that are that are coming forward present a great opportunity for higher education to create new courses that will support our environment. Technology is another one. Look, if we look at automation and so on, again, another challenge, but another opportunity for the higher education sector and system to be able to ensure we have really good graduates, but that we all recognise the fact that it's a journey and we're all on one, and we will be coming back to college and engaging in different ways. And I think that's a key point around lifelong learning. It's the design and the delivery and how that happens.
And I guess, Claire, how employers support and facilitate lifelong learning within the workplace.
Absolutely. And I think you've just hit the nail on the head there, Lorna. It's around, if you look at, I suppose, the dynamic kind of demographic profile that's in the workplace at the moment, you could have up to 5 different generations employed. So that's a huge kind of workplace planning issue. But yet you have all these new kind of societal challenges that are coming more and more to the fore. So the new kind of graduates into the workplace are bringing these great kind of solutions and these kind of good ideas for business to help solve. And then they need to embed within that business. So how do you build those kind of networks internally to help kind of the more tenured employee and the more recent employee work together to collaborate? How do we build employer support for lifelong learning? That, again, it's a back to what Jim's point there about this kind of institutional approach. You actually need it as a company approach. So we need to make sure that lifelong learning is on the CEO's agenda. We also need to make sure that there's support there for individuals and employers to access education programs. And we, as you know, we've been contributing to the National Training Fund. We've made significant increases over the last 3 years into that. And there's a huge opportunity here for this kind of relationship that Jim spoke about between the education system and employers to work together to develop those kind of more bite-sized or those more personalised or even kind of stackable type of kind of education programmes that maybe suit the workplace and the people who are in the workplace to get new skills as they develop. What we probably have to think about is that 45 to 50 year old who's probably need to transition their career at this stage and is taking on a 2 years master's programme ideal for them if they're kind of, you know, time poor because of other challenges that they have in their life. Maybe not. So this is back. I don't call it reform within the education system. I would actually say it's they also need to become a little bit more agile if business has to become more agile.
Yeah, I think there's a clear recognition in the university sector that we need to be more responsive to the needs of industry. And I think, you know, we're already working on some initiatives around that. So, you know, it's not just about the big block of, you know, going back to do a master's or doing another degree. It's about bite-sized chunks, I think, as someone said. So it might be, you know, the engineer who's going into a management role who needs a small module in business law, for example. Like, we have all of those courses available to us, but they're kind of, in some cases, they're locked into a degree program. What we're working to do and what our member institutions are working to do is to extract those and make them available in the chunks that people want to digest them in. But that does require substantial change. And then obviously, as Lorna referenced earlier, you know, the whole digitization of learning as well is how people will access some of those programs is a key piece. And that, of course, in turn does lead us back to the investment piece, because that is a very investment intensive platform to have to deliver.
Okay, so speaking of lifelong learning, what that does require as well, apart from funding and the structures and the actual availability of certain courses, it requires a certain mindset on behalf of the student, which starts far earlier than anything we're talking about now. Probably, you know, secondary school is where you want to be starting to shape that attitude and that desire for lifelong learning. So that's something that I brought up with Alistair Blair, country manager of Accenture Ireland, who we're going to hear from now. He's got a lot to say on how we should be shaping our secondary system in order to shape the students and the employees of the future. We also talked about how the education system can meet the needs of a rapidly evolving business environment. And also we touched on some interesting comments that Apple's Tim Cook made about the education system and the talent pipeline in Ireland.
Business at the Ballot Box. Be the voice.
Yeah, so Accenture Ireland, actually we're 50 years old this year, believe it or not. So we just celebrated our birthday last week. We're what we would call a services firm. We would have been seen as a consulting firm perhaps, but now we're a what I'd call fully fledged services firm working across almost every industry in Ireland. About 3,500 people and rising, I'm glad to say. And we really provide the ability to help solve clients' problems, whether that's in the life sciences industry, whether that's in the tech industry, whether it's in financial services, public sector and beyond.
As a business model and as what you do is, has really evolved to meet the needs of society and your clients over the last few years.
Yeah, I mean, I would say radically. So maybe if I traced my own baby footsteps in the company back 30 odd years ago, we were largely speaking, providing advisory services, what you'd call typical or client management consulting services. And then, of course, the whole tech explosion occurred, where tech has become part of every single business that we work with. It's part of every business. It's part of everyone's lives now. It's in your kitchen, it's in your hand, and it's in your workplace. And that's probably the biggest transition we've seen in what I would call some fairly big leaps over the years. But the most staggering leap has been in the last 5 to 7 years with the really with the deployment of technology, where the power sits with the citizen or the consumer rather than a product being produced by a client or a customer or by a company and delivered. Really, the power sits with the citizen and the consumer to determine how they want to be served, what the product looks like, how quickly they want it to change, and what should good service look like. So a very, very profound change in terms of the services we provide to try and help our clients respond to that.
I know you were at this recent event where Tim Cook of Apple was in Ireland, gave a really interesting speech. And one of the things that came up, he was asked by Martin Shannon of the IDA about the quality of talent in Ireland. And Tim Cook said, quality of talent gets an A+, but we need to keep the education system relevant. Do you believe the education system has stayed relevant in Ireland?
Yeah, so you saw my Twitter feed, obviously. That made me sit up because I totally agree. We, as a business, would totally agree with that. The big thing about the education system is that if you're going to make a radical change to it, which we think is required to take it to the next level, it probably takes 8 to 10 years. One, to get the design right, and two, then to get the next graduates or the next people coming out of second level. We've been a massive net beneficiary in this country, we as a company, but we as a nation, of the decision in the 60s to introduce free secondary level education. So there is an education dividend, or whatever term you want to use. The big challenge we face now is how relevant is an education system in any country to the type of workforce? And we have a very dynamic, very young workforce. How do we make sure that workforce is set up for 5, 7, 10 years? Because we certainly were set up for what has happened in the last 10 years. So what I mean by that, without being too long about it, how do you make sure you change the way education serves people so that they can continue to learn? So I think there's two levels. One is at secondary level, I fear we're going to create and have created a situation where the benefits of learning are converted into points in your leaving cert so you can get to do what you want to do in third level. And that becomes what I call a bit of an arms race, which is you pay whatever it takes to get to those points, to get to what you want to do. That's a problem, I think, because rather than learning, I think we need to help people to think more. And I mean think in terms of bringing together multidisciplinary skills. Whether you're a designer or whether you're a technologist or whether you're somebody who's brilliant at the business process, problems are not solved these days by just having one or other discipline infrequently talking to each other and they hand things off. Our design teams very much focus on multidisciplinary teams working together from start, maybe never to finish, but certainly to product output.
So what do you believe can be changed within the education system to allow for more of this style of education, more development of thinking, etc.?
So I think it's really important, take half a step back. I think it's really important to understand what technology can do. But that's only half the problem. It's what is it going to feel like and what's the experience? When you layer on top of that artificial intelligence and the ability to bestow thinking power in a machine as opposed to the human beings making the judgment, you really need to understand how most things fit together in an answer, or how most things fit together in a product, or how most things fit together when you're helping a client with the product you've just sold them. And I think the education system, perhaps the issue is more in the secondary level, which is this arms race, which is creating a situation where the more you learn, the more you remember, the better likelihood you're going to get a good exam result in one single exam crammed into 3 weeks in a hot sports hall, probably like I was. And I think it's much more about, one, building multidisciplinary skills. That does not mean losing the depth, but it means broadening it out and understanding. If you're a technologist, what is it like to be a designer? What is it like to be a humanities graduate? What is it like to be a sociologist or want to be a sociologist? What's it like to deal with the human side of the implications of technology? And I think the other side of it is we need to find a way whereby it isn't all chips on those 3 weeks in June where we make the bet and the gamble that I've learned enough and I'm going to get through the Leaving Cert. And if I don't, the consequences can be quite stark for people.
How can the next government support your vision for education in Ireland?
I don't think it's a one or a two government thing. I think this is a mindset we need to get to. Imagine the vision that it took to introduce free second level education in Ireland in the late 1960s. I was barely 3 years of age, probably when it was two, maybe when it was introduced. That's, I think, the level of vision we need to adopt. And I think there is a terrific grouping across third, second level, primary level, and all manner of other apprenticeships and other things. We need everyone to decide this is where we want to take this thing. And it's not just about STEM or just about design. So how can the government? We need to recognise the issue, be very clear that we're going to solve it and treat it as an urgent issue, but then commit to the long term. And I mean commit to the long term in terms of the changes, and a substantial investment, because it ain't a quick fix.
IBEC, the voice of Irish business.
Alistair Blair, Country Managing Director for Accenture Ireland there. I'm still joined by Lorna Fitzpatrick of the Union of Students of Ireland, Jim Miley, Director General of the Irish Universities Association, and Claire McGee, Head of Education and Innovation Policy at IBEC. And Claire, your thoughts on what Alistair Blair of Accenture Ireland had to say there?
Well, it's always interesting to hear from Alistair, because Accenture really have that kind of bird's eye view of what's actually happening across multiple different industries. And they're also significant employers of graduates, I think nearly up to 200 graduate employees per annum. So always very, very interested to hear what they say. But his comments are very timely. This year has kick-started kind of a review of the Leaving Cert, or senior cycle as it's officially known. And it's probably the first major review in about 50 years. So very important to have a business voice in that, because we can kind of shine a light on really what the future direction of travel is going to be. And I sometimes think about myself in a sense, you know, after you did I did my Leaving Cert and then you move into college. And after I finished that, I wondered, was I just so exhausted by the whole learning experience that I could not lift up another book for another period of time? And I would not say I'm alone in that. So what are we doing at second level? Because if you think about it, we now have young people who go to primary school and are so excited about primary school. They absolutely love it. And that has been a major transformation. We have to give credit to all the major stakeholders who've challenged that. And then second level appears. And I wonder, does it kind of push out all that enjoyment, all that enthusiasm, and it tends to focus more so on, you know, certain type of academic learning. It becomes a game, an arms race, as he called it, a points race, very pressurised. And what you have then are very smart individuals, strategic people, the people that, you know, businesses of the future are looking for, ultimately gaming the system to get the most amount of points without actually maybe following their passions. And business of the future want passionate people to help solve those big societal challenges around consumer preferences, you know, global orientation, people with an international outlook. And yet, I just wonder at second level, have we caught pace with that? So now's the time, I think, if we can encourage parents, students, business, employers, third level stakeholders to really engage with this process around kind of senior cycle or Leaving Cert reform, because now's our opportunity. And I think if we don't take it, we'll all be sorry the next election time it comes around.
Lorna Fitzpatrick, you were nodding enthusiastically there. You agree?
Yeah, most definitely. I think looking at the second level system and the senior cycle and the reform there, it'll be absolutely key. I think that the benefits to reform in terms of our society society are huge. And that's to business, it's to our higher education institutions, to our innovation and research and so on. But it just in society at large, like none of us operate in silos, and we need to recognise that there are connections across the board and that we can support each other in achieving those connections. In terms of the third level student and the benefit of the reform there, like the comments there around the points race and so on are so key. And I think it comes back to the point that was made earlier around lifelong learning and the design and the delivery or the mode of delivery around courses. We need to make sure that we're approaching this in a partnership approach, really, and that it serves the needs of everybody, including our society, but is done so in a partner, is approached, I suppose, through partnership, so that everybody is having the opportunity to engage, so that everyone can get the best results out of it, I suppose.
Jim Miley.
I think Alistair is so right. I think if we don't address the second level issue here, then I think, you know, we're in terms of, you know, delivering the kind of really competitive knowledge based economy for the future, we won't get there. I think we have a couple of cultural barriers to overcome that have been referenced. We have this culture of what I would say is a factory or warehousing of second level and in the third level. There's this kind of notion that you land them into a school or a campus and you put them out the other side,
spit back to your cake,
spit them out on the other side, and off you go there into industry, and you're done now. Mm-hmm. The real world, hasn't been like that for some time, and it absolutely won't be like that in the future.
It's not linear.
Absolutely not linear. So I think we need to, so there's that kind of systematic cultural change in the second level, and then there's a systematic cultural change, because I think if you do a survey of, and you get the attitudes of parents around the country whose sons or daughters are thinking of going to third level, they think only of third level in terms of 18, 19, 20, 21 year olds, and actually at the moment, there's a significant proportion of second time or boomerang students, as they're sometimes called, and that is going to increase substantially. And in countries like, if you look at our key competitors in Denmark, like I think we have something like 7% of, I don't think lifelong learning is measured very well in Ireland, but in as far as it's measured, about 1 in 8
we're below 10% participation,
back in Denmark that's 30%. Like, so that's the reality, and they're the people who are doing this really well.
And that's where we're going to get to. Final word from you, Claire McGee.
I think that's the essence of this. How do we serve all the partners, who are going to benefit from that? The students, the graduates, employers, business, and the education system. And ultimately what we need to do is be lighting that spark for lifelong learning. How do you bridge your deep technical knowledge with those kind of very necessary employability and life skills? And what we need to do is make sure that we resource our system to enable to encourage that.
Lovely place to leave. Claire McGee, Head of Education and Innovation Policy at IBEC, Lorna Fitzpatrick, President of the Union of Students in Ireland, and Jim Miley, Director General of the Irish Universities Association. Thank you so much for your time today. And that is it for today. Thank you very much for tuning in. And if you would like to be part of the conversation, join us on Twitter and LinkedIn using the hashtag BeTheVoice. And you can also email us through ibecpodcasts@ibec.ie. And of course, make sure to follow or subscribe to the series if you're enjoying it. And we will drop episodes for free into your inbox every day. We will be back tomorrow with an analysis of another key election issue directly relevant to business leaders and their workforce. In the meantime, do check out our previous episodes in the series where we have heard some brilliant opinions and solutions from people such as Anne O'Leary of Vodafone, Dalton Phillips of DAA, Caroline Lennon of AIR, Brendan Courtney, designer and elder care campaigner, Patricia King of the Irish Congress of Trade Unions, and of course Danny McCoy and many of IBEC's policy leads. You will find those at ibec.ie on your favourite podcast platforms, and we've also got some great short video clips of these interviews on IBEC's Twitter and LinkedIn channels. See you next time.
Business at the Ballot Box. Be the voice.